Coming to you from the Forge of Freedom studio in the heart of America, a podcast dedicated to preserving freedom and inspiring personal success. Freedom is born and lives through you, the individual, and it dies in the shadows of tyranny, motivating our listeners to become well-rounded, freedom-minded people with the body of an athlete, the mind of a stoic, and the spirit of a warrior. The Tree of Liberty lives on through you, the Forge of Freedom. And now here's your host, Alex Uli.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Forge of Freedom podcast. I'm your host, Alex Uli, and this is episode 33 of the Forge of Freedom. Today, I have attorney and firearms instructor Mike Uli back in the studio for Monday Gun Day to discuss selecting a handgun for self-defense for beginners. Welcome to the show again, Mike.
Hey, thanks, Alex, for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So today we're going to talk about selecting a firearm, and if you're a beginner, selecting a firearm for self-defense. And for a lot of people, this decision can feel overwhelming because there are so many options and so much information out there. It's hard to parse through it all, especially for beginners. And it can be challenging to determine what qualities, what factors to prioritize when selecting the firearm. A lot of times if you go to a gun shop, the common advice is just to choose a firearm that feels good in your hand. And it's like, well, what does that mean? And how do you know that if you're a beginning shooter, because you don't know what a gun should feel like in your hand. So a lot of times the advice you get at the gun store is not all that helpful. And relying solely on your budget can be misleading or a poor factor, a poor way to approach the selection of a firearm. So we want to just talk about what are the factors you should consider, and we're not going to give you the answers by any stretch. We're just going to give you the things that you should consider so that you can make an informed decision on your own. And this is a lot more nuanced than a lot of people lead you to believe sometimes. There are so many factors to consider. So we're going to outline some general guidelines for selecting a firearm, a handgun for self-defense. We'll talk about some specific models that you might consider, might look at. We think a lot of beginners are well-suited beginning with, but we're not going to give you an exhaustive list or an exclusive list by any stretch. And we'll also, of course, include some helpful resources in the show notes. We'll link to those resources as we talk about those through the show. So with that said, Mike, let's talk a little bit about, I said this show is for beginners. Who are we really talking to here?
Well, I think, and I hope folks don't take offense to this, but we're really talking about novices is who we're, our audience. So we have a training company, and we do quite a bit of training. They're mostly NRA courses, anything from the basic course all the way through defensive pistol courses. But we see a lot of folks who are in the very beginning stages of thinking about using a firearm for self-defense. And I think it's important too, in today's climate, a lot of people over the last, with the COVID stuff and, you know, a lot of things that have happened in the world, riots and that sort of thing, a lot of people have really thought more and more seriously about firearms. And these are people who previously either didn't own a firearm, they weren't even around firearms to a great extent. So that's who we're sort of talking about here today. And we're going to give you some of the things that we've seen. I want, like you said, I mean, everybody's got an opinion. We're going to express some of our opinions today. They may be right. They may be wrong. You do what you want with those. But I think you at least need to think about these things. And one thing before we get into the firearms, when we talk about a firearm for self-defense, I mean, that is a tool of last resort. And I think a lot of people in today's world where there's a lot of anxiety, they immediately think about a firearm. Which is good. Everybody ought to, in my world, everybody has a firearm. What's the saying about
everybody? Our society is a polite society.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about Paul Lathrop's podcast, as a matter of fact. So anyway, there are lots of things, though, before a firearm. We've talked about this before, awareness, avoidance. There are less lethal options. I'm a big fan of pepper spray. We've got a large German Shepherd downstairs. She goes a long way for awareness for us. So anyway, there are lots of things you can do short of a firearm, but we're never going to use a firearm unless we're facing an immediate, otherwise unavoidable threat of death or great bodily harm to us or another innocent. So that's an extreme case. There are lots of things short of that standard where we may need to use some other tool in self-defense. And of course, a win is always avoidance. But I want to say that as a caveat. The second caveat before we talk about the equipment. Last week, we talked about Jeff Cooper and Gunsight and his combat triad, which consists of marksmanship, gun handling, and most importantly, probably the mindset. So I want to emphasize that, you know, I think folks fixate on the tool, the firearm. And that's what we're going to kind of fall into that trap a little bit today and talk about that. But there are other things that are far more important than the tool itself, because quite frankly, there are so many, we're living in sort of a golden age of firearms. There are so many manufacturers out there. There are so many models. You'd be hard pressed to find a low quality firearm out there, no matter who makes it. So please, that's one mistake I think we see novices make, and that is not understanding. It just takes a lot of time, effort, and dedication to get a proficient level of competency with a firearm. And it's about that gun handling competency. It's about the marksmanship. It's about the mindset and not the gun. As Jeff Cooper said, something to the effect that just because you have a piano doesn't make you a musician. So it's all the other things that we have to put around that tool.
Yeah, certainly. Most of your time and effort should be spent working on the person behind the gun, not the gun itself.
Yes. But one thing I noticed too, we talked about Gunsight last week and Jeff Cooper. I've noticed that Gunsight, their sort of premier core class is what they call the Gunsight 250 class, which is a week-long class, 5 days of training. But I noticed, and I'm not sure when, relatively recently, they've added something called Day Zero. And this is a new, just I think it's just a one-day class that they offer the day before a Gunsight 250 course starts. And that's to help, I think, the novice or the brand new gun owner who really lacks even the basic knowledge and skills necessary to properly handle a gun, or maybe even the basic marksmanship skills. I like to think the classes that we teach, frankly, are to a certain extent like that. It prepares folks to go and I think take a 250 class at Gunsight or that sort of thing. That's the sort of thing that's most rewarding to me is somebody wants to further their training. So anyway, we talked about the peripheries and the caveats. I suppose we can talk about
And I think your point too is one of the points we think people should consider the most is it's a good idea to get training before you actually purchase a firearm, because that training will inform your decision about what may be a good firearm for you. So whether it's this Day Zero at Gunsight 250 or it's an NRA basic pistol class like what we teach, seek out some training from a reputable trainer, not just the state mandated training if you're in a state that mandates training. Seek out some good training. It's going to be at least a day long, more than likely, to really get you the information you need to know what it takes to be a responsible gun owner and to figure out what sort of firearm might be best suited for you.
Yeah, it's sort of, think about a car, at least, well, I don't know, in today's world, at least me, my generation, you wouldn't think about buying a car or a truck or an SUV unless you went out and test drove it. As a matter of fact, it'd probably be better to rent one or spend a day or two with one before so you can decide whether you like something or not. One of the things that's most disappointing to me and most difficult in our training classes is when somebody buys a gun, it's a brand, you know, they've read all the internet forums and the whatever and listened to some folks who probably have never had any training. They bring this nice new shiny gun. It's not technically shiny, but you know what I'm saying, to class, and they find out it's not the gun for them. They've spent $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 on this gun, and they find out that it's the wrong gun. So I think that is incredibly important for novices is to go take a course and, you know, learn some things, try some guns out before you make a final decision.
And we're attorneys, so
don't hold that against us.
Exactly. But there are also some legal considerations that people should keep in mind. And we teach a 5-hour class about the legal aspects of firearms ownership and self-defense. But you don't want to buy a firearm and have no clue what the laws are about how you can store it, how you can carry it, where you can take it, what are prohibited places, etc. So make sure that if you already have one, you seek out that sort of information. But ideally, you would seek out that information before you actually own and possess a firearm, because you don't want to get caught up in the legal pitfalls that you can find yourself in if you break a law that's specific to your state or even a violation of federal law. So we think, and we'll mention this, certainly link to this in the show notes, but handgunlaw.us is a great resource with a digest of state-specific laws. But there are also lots of other great resources out there. And there are other people who teach classes like we teach. So if you have that opportunity where you are to take a class about the legal aspects of firearms ownership and self-defense, certainly encourage you to do that as well.
Yeah, handgunlaw.us is a great source. I use it from time to time. So anyway, it's a great source. Get training, take our class. You got to fill in the context of, you know, that tool. You buy this tool and there's a lot that goes around it.
Yeah. So with that said, let's get into the actual topic for the details of the topic for today, the selecting a handgun for self-defense for beginners. So number one, the number one consideration is obviously going to be the purpose of the firearm when selecting a firearm, but that's contained in the topic of the show. It's for self-defense, a handgun for self-defense. So that's the number one consideration. But what are some other considerations, Mike, just to kind of start out?
Well, we've decided that we're going to use the handgun for self. We want to keep it for self-defense. We hope we don't have to use it for self-defense, but we want to have that tool available to us if we absolutely have to use it. And I think one of the things that to further define or refine that purpose is folks need to decide whether or not this is going to be simply a home defense gun that's kept in a small, maybe a biometric safe, you know, in a nightstand, secured, that you're going to keep just in the home? Or is this going to be a firearm that you want to carry? And with that comes lots of considerations, because a large 40-ounce 1911 is more difficult to carry than a smaller, more modern polymer handgun. So that's one consideration folks are going to have to really take a hard, serious look at is whether, like I said, it's going to be in the home or they're going to carry it out there in public. I'll just start talking about how to select these firearms. First of all, another little small caveat, make sure you ingrain in yourself the safety rules. We always want to make sure these are the general safety rules. We always want to make sure we keep the firearm pointed in a safe direction. We want to treat all firearms as if they're loaded, whether we think they are or not. We're going to always treat them that way. We're going to keep our finger off the trigger until we're ready to shoot. And we're always going to be sure of our target and what's beyond, what's before, what's around it. Okay, so that's always something that we're going to have to take into consideration when we're using the firearm. Another thing before we get in, and I'll get into the selection in a second, but we're assuming that you want a handgun here today, not a shotgun or a rifle, which might be in, I won't say better, but I mean, folks may need to make that determination. This show is not about rifle, shotgun, or handgun, but we're assuming today you're going to choose a handgun. So the first thing that folks have to decide, I think, if they're going to get a handgun, is whether they want a revolver or a semi-auto pistol. And there's certainly nothing at all wrong with a revolver at all. One of the mistakes, and I hate to talk about mistakes, but one of the mistakes I see people make, and I don't mean this in a negative way or at all, but they bring a very small revolver to class, what's classically referred to as a Smith & Wesson J-frame, which are wonderful guns. I have one. I carry one sometimes. I think everybody ought to have one and learn how to shoot it. But that's not the gun that you probably should start out with. People are under the impression, I think, when they go to gun stores that they go in, and I don't mean to be sexist, but here's what happens, it seems, in my experience. Particularly females, they go to a gun store and they want to buy the one that's the smallest and feels best in their hand right there at the counter. Well, just because it feels nice at the counter doesn't mean it's going to feel nice when you shoot it at the range or wherever. And smaller guns are generally more difficult to shoot. Revolver, sometimes it takes quite a bit of hand strength to actuate the action, to press the trigger. You're going to get a 12, 14, 16, 17 pound trigger pull on those things. So some people have a hard time pressing that trigger and maintaining a good sight alignment, sight picture, because of the difficulty in pulling the trigger for them as a result of their hand strength. We have a short sight radius, which makes it difficult to sight the small revolvers. So we want to stay away from those if we can. If you want a revolver, you need one with a little longer barrel, probably at least 4 inches to start with, in my estimation. Revolvers are fine. They're very, for the most part, simple, incredibly reliable. You're going to give up a little bit in terms of ammunition capacity with a revolver, but they're fine firearms. I don't know if there's any, and I've seen you, Alex, you mentioned last week training with Dennis Reichert. You can be incredibly accurate and effective with him. I've seen him hit silhouette sized targets at 100 yards with a J-frame revolver that has actually you were using a Ruger at the time, an LCR, but you know, it has a 1 7/8, 2 inch barrel, something like that.
So. And I got a lot of hell for having a Ruger revolver because Dennis Reichert was a Smith & Wesson guy. He said couldn't hit anything with a Ruger from more than 10 feet, basically.
Yeah, I think you were the only one there with a Ruger, if memory serves me. But anyway,
a revolver can be a great option, but you're right, Mike. A lot of people have this misconception, especially new shooters, that the small revolver is going to be the best gun for them, and it's usually not, because they are very difficult to shoot, very difficult to learn on. They're not bad guns. They're just not typically going to be the best gun for a beginner.
Yep. And what you'll see just real quickly, and I don't want to take a lot of time on this, but the larger frame revolvers are probably J-frame is a, I'm talking Smith & Wesson here. And by the way, the Rugers are great. They're little LCRs. They have a different trigger mechanism. The trigger press just out of the box is really, really good. But Smith & Wesson has a K, the larger frames, which are going to be heavier and bigger. They have K frames, and then they have L frames, and then they have N frames, and then I think they even have an X frame or something, which is like the huge grizzly bear guns is what they amount to. But anyway, there are lots of options out there for revolvers. They're generally speaking, unless you get the J frame, which is not a beginner gun in my estimation, they're going to be pretty heavy though, for the most part.
But heavier is not necessarily bad, right? That heavier actually helps you with respect to physics, because the mass of the firearm absorbs some of the energy of the firearm when it ignites or when it goes off. So the heaviness of the gun actually helps you feel less recoil. But the problem with all revolvers is that you mentioned the 12, 14 pound trigger pull. That's the difficulty of pulling the trigger also makes it more difficult to shoot and get accurate hits on target.
And I think we need to say this too. The reason we talk about the stiff trigger press or trigger pull on a revolver is because for self-defense purposes, you're always going to shoot it in double action mode. You're not going to cock the hammer first and then press the trigger in single action when it's relatively easy to press. So it's always going to be used in double action mode. And by double action, just real quick, this is not a class, but double action means the trigger performs two functions. It cocks the hammer and it releases the hammer. In single action mode, the trigger only performs one function and it releases the hammer. So as you might imagine, when it's doing two things, it's much more difficult to press the trigger or pull the trigger because it's cocking the hammer. You're working against springs and mechanical energy versus single action. It's only releasing the hammer, so it's a much easier press. But during the adrenaline-filled event of a potential self-defense encounter, we don't want that very light trigger press that using a single action or using a revolver in single action mode brings us.
So we've been talking about revolvers up to this point, and revolvers can be good firearms for beginners, but there are some difficulties associated with operating a revolver. Like you said, the trigger presses, especially in double action, is quite difficult, especially for a beginner. But One thing that would apply not only to revolvers, but also semi-automatics is that for beginners, we think people should start out with a slightly longer barrel, probably in the 4-inch range, because having the longer barrel gives the shooter a longer sight radius, which is the distance between the rear sight and the front sight, which would make the firearm easier to shoot. And then also having a longer barrel means the gun is going to be a larger gun with more mass. You'll have less perceived recoil.
Yeah, because generally speaking, and remember, once again, I'm going to revert back to Colonel Cooper. What's it take to win a gunfight? It takes speed, accuracy, and power. And power, we usually talk about a heavy-duty handgun that can survive the rigors of combat and be effective as a handgun can be. But we've got that speed and accuracy balance that we have to come up with. And remember, you can never miss fast enough to win a gunfight. So accuracy is always the most important thing in my mind compared to speed, at least at first.
So we've talked about
at first
the revolver, and here we're talking about double action revolvers, not single action cowboy style revolvers. Those are typically not going to be good for self-defense. Obviously, if it's the only thing you've got, you know, you go with what you've got. But we're talking about double action revolvers, which like Mike said, means the trigger performs two functions. It cocks the hammer and releases the hammer.
Yeah, and most of these smaller J-frame revolvers, the hammer is not going to be exposed. There's still a hammer there, but it's shrouded in the frame. And we want that in a self-defense situation because first of all, we're not going to use the hammer to cock the gun in a self-defense scenario. And number two, we don't have to worry about the hammer getting hung up on clothing or that sort of thing.
So we've talked about revolvers. Let's get into the semi-automatic handguns. There are a few different types. You want to talk about those, Mike?
Yeah, and we talked about a lot of the negatives with regard to a revolver. Once again, I just want to say going out, it's a great choice. Just know what you're getting into when you go that way, because there are lots of advantages too. Most people are going to pick a semi-automatic handgun, a pistol, and there are lots of iterations of those as well. And I don't know if we want to take the time to get into explaining all of these. And I'm just going to start out real opinionated here off the bat, because there are lots of things and you can get into the weeds. But if most, and I don't have the statistics, but probably 90-95% of the police departments in this country, public civilians, we're private civilians, but these public servants who are civilians as well, they're equipped with what are called polymer striker fired handguns. And these are Glocks, M&P. You'll hear that name a lot. You'll hear Sig Sauer 320s. I think the Army adopted that. Time gets away from me, a few years ago. But that's probably the vast majority of what police departments use. And now, we don't use things because the police department uses them. I just bring this point up because they're probably the easiest to train people on, get them started, and allow them to, in the least amount of time, to effectively and efficiently use a handgun. So probably that's where the vast majority of people ought to start. That's my opinion. If you want some of these other firearms, they're great firearms. I own them. I've used them. But it is going to take probably more training and more effort and more discipline to be able to use them effectively.
And I think for the purpose of this episode, we can just mention that you said striker fired handgun. Those are handguns that do not have a hammer. They have a striker that's captivated inside of the slide, inside of the firearm, that's captivated by a spring. The spring, when it's cocked, has pressure. And then when you press the trigger, there's a block that drops and allows the spring to throw the striker forward and ignite the cartridge. So there's no hammer inside the striker-fired handgun. The other two types of semi-automatics have hammers. There's the 1911 style, which is a single-action handgun that only, again, just like the revolvers, the single-action means the trigger performs one function. It releases the hammer. And then there are double-action handguns, and these typically operate in double or single. Sometimes you see the nomenclature DA/SA. Where the first trigger press is double action, the second trigger press is single action. And there are some that are double action only, especially the smaller, more compact double action semi-automatic firearms. But for our purposes, we think for the beginner, the striker-fired handgun is the best place to start. And that's because these other types of semi-automatic handguns have more complicated functions. So there, a lot of times there are decockers, there are external manual safeties, et cetera, that make them more difficult to shoot, more difficult to train on and learn on. So they're not bad firearms. They're just more difficult to learn on, more difficult to use, and harder to learn on as a beginner.
Yep. And for instance, a 1911, and I'm going to you know, take our class for that, go into all that thing, but the 1911 is a single action. There is no better handgun in terms of a trigger press than a 1911. It's a you can have an incredible, crisp trigger press. It's great. But the manual of arms that comes with a 1911 is more difficult than the typical striker fire gun. And thank you for defining the term striker fire, because I was using a term without defining it. But I want to go back. Think about it. Police departments have limited budgets, limited training time. So they've got to get these police officers up to, we hope, at least a minimum level of proficiency with a firearm. So they select these striker fire guns that are relatively simple to operate. The trigger press is the same every time. A lot of these guns, for instance, the double action, single action guns, you've got to master two types of trigger presses. They feel differently, first shot versus subsequent shots. But they're easier to train officers so they can at least get to that a minimum level of proficiency. Because you got to remember, police officers, some of them are gun people, some of them aren't gun people. And you need to get them up to a basic level of safe operation of a firearm. And so that's why I said initially, that's probably where you ought to go, is some of the same firearms that the civilian police use. Like I said, not because they use them, we don't care about that, but for the same reasons that they select them. Unless you're a competition shooter and, you know, you just love 1911s, which I have and carried for a long, long time. You probably ought to, if it's just a basic tool you don't care about but want to be able to use, a striker fire gun is a good place to start.
And one of the reasons, this is getting into the weeds a little bit, but one of the reasons we emphasize simplicity is because when we're talking about training and using a firearm for self-defense, we want to have to master as few skills as possible. And when you're facing a life or death situation, you want those skills to be second nature. You don't want to have to think about them when you're facing that threat in front of you. So the simpler the firearm is to use, the fewer skills, the fewer manipulations you have to master to become second nature, which is why we think not only is it easier to learn on as a beginner, but it's easier to master.
Yep. That firearm, you have to remember, it's about gun handling and marksmanship and mindset. But those gun handling and marksmanship skills, particularly the gun handling, they have to be trained to a level of unconscious competence, which means you need to be able to manipulate that firearm just like you're tying your shoes. You don't have to consciously think about it. It needs to be like when you hit the brakes on your car, you see the brake lights of the car in front. You don't process it, think about it. You just immediately put your foot on the brake. And that's the way our manipulations and gun handling needs to be with respect to a firearm. The striker fire gun, and like I said, don't send us hate mail. I like a 1911 better, no question, myself. But a striker fire makes a lot of sense for most folks.
Yeah, especially beginners. So we've talked about this, touched on it a little bit. But for the beginner, what should they be thinking about in terms of the size and weight of a firearm?
We've alluded to this already before. First of all, you're going to think a little bit. Once again, you're going to carry the gun, or is it going to be just a home defense gun? Those are not necessarily mutually exclusive, but it's something you need to consider because some people are very sensitive to the size of the gun in terms of carry. They just don't want to carry what I would consider to be a full-size gun. The larger guns are generally, you'll have less perceived recoil, and they're going to be a little easier to shoot accurately, and actually they're going to be easier to shoot with greater speed. So that's going to have to be a consideration. Now, I'm going to throw something out to you, and I'm really going to get people kind of hating me probably, but I'll give you kind of two benchmarks. A Glock 19 and maybe a Smith & Wesson M&P Compact 9. And we'll get to caliber in a little bit. But those two firearms, if you look at those, and I think, the size of those guns, they're a little bit big. The grips are, because they're what's called a double stack magazine, which means the they're going to hold like 15 rounds. But those two guns are going to be in the, I think, 20, 22, 23 ounces range. They're going to have 4-inch barrels. They're going to have a grip that lets you get your hand fully on the grip and grip the gun effectively. But that's probably those two guns. There are others out there. FN makes some 509 compacts, I think. But I'm not trying to say any brand's better than the other. But those two guns, the Glock 19 M&P 9 compact, probably in my mind, that's a minimum size gun somebody ought to start out with. I'm not saying if carry is your only thing and you want something as small as you can get it, maybe a SIG 365 or a Smith & Wesson, Shield. But those, to me, are kind of getting on the small side. I'd rather see somebody start with that Glock 19 M&P compact size or larger. If you want to go larger, a Glock 40, they got a new Glock 47, a Glock 17, M&P full size, FN 509, SIG 320.
And when you say M&P, you're referring to the Smith & Wesson. Yes. So the Smith & Wesson M&P 9 compact. And so here our default is 9mm, which is the caliber.
We'll talk about that.
And we'll talk about caliber more later, but we think that should be sort of the default. But the Glock 19 is also 9mm. Mm-hmm. So that we think the Glock 19 and the Smith & Wesson M&P 9 compact are both good sort of starting points. And as you get more comfortable shooting and you get more proficient at manipulating the firearm, you might, if you're more concerned about concealability, you might move down in size if that's important to you. But we think to learn the marksmanship skills, to learn gun handling skills, that size, the Glock 19 or larger size, is the best starting point.
Yeah, and I don't mean, I want to ask you to explain something in a minute, just give you a heads up, the magazine release, because I'm going to mention an H&K, for instance. I don't mean to say that, you know, you got to buy Smith & Wesson or Glock. A CZ makes, I think it's a P10, it's a striker fired gun.
P10C.
Yeah, CZ makes good guns. FN makes some like that. SIG has got their modular stuff, the 320, you can configure one of those so it's about the same size as a Glock 19 and make it bigger, and it does all kinds of, you can change things around. I really don't know all the intricacies of that, but there are lots of handguns out there in this style. Like I said earlier, I'm not sure anybody makes a bad gun anymore. I know Canik, I've got used one. Canik is probably a little more, if you're price conscious, and that may be offensive to Canik users, I don't mean that in a bad way. I think they run a little bit less in terms of money, but what I've heard is great things about those. I know Palmetto Seed Army even makes a lower price gun now, but I don't think there's any bad guns out there for the most part anyway. Be careful. The H&Ks are great. Ergonomics is a German company, as you might imagine, great engineering, but they have a paddle magazine release. Some of their models do, which you want to try to explain that to them without showing that.
So typically on a handgun, there's a magazine release, which is the device. The magazine is the device that holds the cartridges inside the gun. And when you have to reload or change your magazine, you have to release it with typically what's a button on the side of the handgun. Well, the H&K is a little unique in that it's not a button that you press, it's a paddle that you push down to release the magazine. And just that slight nuance makes it unique. It makes it something that if you like that firearm, you would have to train on if you're not used to that. But there's nothing wrong with it. Some people prefer it. In fact, John Correa from Active Self Protection, that's his preferred firearm, is an H&K VP9, which would be similar to a Glock 19, except that it has the paddle magazine release rather than the button style magazine release.
Yeah, and I think they're really, I've shot them not extensively. They're nice guns. They feel good. I'm just not ready to change to the European style paddle safety.
So we've talked about size and weight. In the Glock 19 and the Smith & Wesson M&P 9 compact, along with the H&K VP9 and the SIG P320, you can get all of these in a similar size that's about, like you said, a little north of 20 ounces in weight. but also has approximately a 4-inch barrel length, which we think is a good standard for beginners.
Yeah, and if you just want one gun, those guns or another gun like them, that size, that form factor, it can be a very good just home defense gun, but it could be a gun that you can still carry and manage easily in terms of concealed carry. Now, if you can carry a what I consider a full-size Glock 17 or the M&P 2.0 that's full-size or some of these full-size guns, that's fine. But the Glock 19, the ones we're describing, are a little bit smaller, a little bit more manageable in terms of concealed carry.
Yeah, I kind of like to look at it. The 4-inch barrel, 9mm striker-fired handgun is kind of like the F-150 of the gun world. You can, it's not a big truck that you can do lots of work with. It's not a small vehicle that you can, you know, like a Toyota Prius that you can conceal easily, but you can do kind of about anything with it.
Yeah, it's not the perfect gun, but it's kind of a jack of all trades.
Yep, exactly. So we've talked about size and weight. We're going to get to caliber here in just a little bit. One thing that we see people struggle with sometimes, especially older female shooters in particular, is difficulty racking the slide. That's another reason to go with a larger firearm, like the 4-inch barrel plus, because it's easier to rack the slide than it is on a smaller gun.
And what you mean by racking the slide is in a semi-automatic pistol or handgun, that the slide, the top part of the gun, it's a metal part, it has to reciprocate back and forth when the gun is discharged. So the cartridge is discharged, the bullet comes out the end of the end of the barrel, the muzzle, and then the slide has to come back. It has to eject the spent brass and then load another cartridge. And that's what and when you load a semi-automatic pistol, you have to manipulate or rack that slide.
Yeah, it's so the more compact semi-automatics, in order to operate effectively, have to have a stiffer spring, and it makes it more difficult to manipulate that slide. So a longer barrel helps with that. But then there are also some companies, Smith & Wesson is one, that has developed firearms that are marketing to that that customer, the one that has difficulty with their hand strength, and make firearms that are easier to rack the slide.
Yeah. And I think those are, and once again, when we use the term marketing, I don't want to say it's just marketing. It is marketing, but it's also from what, and I haven't shot them extensively, but from my experience, limited experience with them, they are in fact easier to rack the slide or reciprocate the slide. And
that's the EZ models.
Yeah,
and I think it's an M&P EZ.
Yeah, and I think they actually have an internal hammer that helps with that versus the traditional striker fire. But anyway, it doesn't how they do the magic. I'm not going to speak to that with any degree of authority, but they do in fact to me seem easier to operate. Now, part of that in some cases is that you know they use a 380 caliber cartridge. But even the 9mm EZs, which I think they make, seem like they're easier to manipulate than a traditional 9mm, like a Glock 19, for instance. Now, is that the only criteria you should use? Well, it depends on your situation and the kind of hand strength you have. I know for you, that's not important. You don't have a problem racking the slide. So anyway, that's something that's important to people. And I think we'll go ahead and mention caliber just real quickly, because caliber goes into a certain extent how easy it is to rack that slide, so to speak. We think, I think it's a consensus amongst most trainers and people that I respect that 380 is sort of the minimum, bare minimum caliber centerfire cartridge. And we'll talk about 22 in a little bit, but the kind of the minimum cartridge for self-defense. Most people, it seems anymore, want at least one to 9mm. That's kind of the F-150 of the cartridge world. But there are also 40s, which are losing their popularity, 40 caliber, and 45 ACP, still popular. Used to be really popular, I think, before ammunition advances came along with hollow point ammunition and ammunition performance. When we just shot what was traditionally ball ammo, and I don't want to get into that too much, except think of it as just an old-fashioned piece of lead that didn't expand and that sort of thing. The 45 was probably better then, no question about that. With today's modern ammunition, any benefit you get from the 45 is probably, I'm going to make a lot of people angry here, is probably marginal at this juncture, given bullet performance.
And probably outweighed by capacity, by recoil, the ease of subsequent shots, follow-up shots, etc. So 9mm has a lot of advantages. Doesn't mean that 45 is not still good. It is still a very good cartridge, and if that's your preference, that's totally fine. But we think that 9mm is kind of the standard.
Yeah, and so I guess the bottom line here is, if you really have a hard time manipulating the firearm, you're really recoil sensitive, 380 is probably going to be easier for you than the 9, but you're going to give up a little performance, in terms of the cartridge's ballistic performance.
Yeah.
Over the 9mm or 40 or 45.
And just so people know, I mean, 380 is the same diameter bullet as a 9mm, but it has less powder and
generally less weight to the bullet.
Generally less weight and less velocity. So you don't get as much energy, as much so-called stopping power with a 380. And but it's sufficient, we think, but it's kind of the bare minimum.
Yeah. I mean, would I rather have a 9 than a 380? Yeah. Would I rather have a 45 than a 3? Yeah. But, you know, it seems like that's the consensus, is 380. If you have to, you can go that low.
9mm ammunition is also cheaper, so it's easier to get in more practice for less money with a 9mm than 45 or 380.
Yeah, and once again, I mean, it's not like on TV where somebody's shot and they're thrown back 12 feet or something. I mean, frankly, rather than get into which handgun caliber is the best, just they're all ineffective compared to a rifle or a shotgun. So anyway, we won't get into that. But one thing I will mention this real quickly, I think it's a really good idea for people that consider themselves novices or just getting into this. I like, and this is what we do in our training classes with folks that think they're going to be incredibly recoil sensitive, or people who have had a bad experience with a firearm. We see this with some regularity, unfortunately. Somebody comes in and their boyfriend or their somebody in their family has given them a 44 Magnum with a 4-inch barrel to shoot for their first time, to shoot a firearm.
Because they thought it'd be fun.
Thought it'd be funny. And by the way, it's not only is it in bad taste, there have been people that have been killed on ranges as a result of giving a large caliber handgun to somebody and then they errantly shoot a second round. But anyway, people that have had bad experiences and they're really, quote, gun shy, end quote, recoil sensitive, because they've had this horrible first experience with a firearm, a lot of times we'll give them a 22 to start out with, a 22 semi-automatic. And that's a great place to start because they can have a lot of success with it. There's not a lot of recoil. The marksmanship fundamentals are the same, whether you're shooting a 22 or a 44 Magnum. So it's a good way to kind of build up their confidence, their skills, without worrying about, the pain of a larger caliber handgun or going through these previous experiences they've had that they previously had. We like 22s that are identical or nearly identical to the larger caliber handguns. And it sounds like I'm a Glock person, but I'll give you an example. I just use this for an example. Glock makes a model 44 in 22 caliber long rifle. So it's a model 44, but it shoots a 22. And it is identical in terms of not weight, it's going to be lighter, but in terms of dimensions, it's identical to a Glock 19. The way you manipulate it will be the same. So you can use this 22. It's very low in recoil. It's cheap to shoot. 22 is a lot cheaper than 9mm, so you can get a lot of repetitions. And then you can move into, for instance, a Glock 19, and you don't have to relearn anything, and there's no difference in terms of pistol gun handling manipulation. Smith & Wesson makes a M&P Compact 22. It's not quite identical to any of their larger caliber, but it's pretty close. And I understand that, I don't know this for a fact, that 6 hour is now making some sort of 22 that's similar or at least maybe even almost identical to their 320 line, which is an incredibly popular line of pistols for them. So that's something we would encourage you to look at. I know I have a Glock 44, for instance, because you can just go shoot it and it's cheap to shoot and you can get lots of shots in. And that's what we put our students in too, is just shoot these 22s. And we've had lots and lots and lots of rounds through the Smith & Wesson M&P Compacts and the Glock 44, and they perform, I mean, we use them in classes, so there are lots of rounds. They perform admirably, both of those. We've used a lot of other 22s that I won't mention that don't perform on the same level as those two handguns.
Yeah. So 22, if you can find one that's similar to the 9mm that you're interested in, if you can find one that has the same size, the same grip, the same trigger press, et cetera, you can get in good practice with cheaper ammunition, lower recoil, et cetera. So it's a great place to start for a novice, but it's even a great training tool as you advance in your skill level.
Yeah, and I'll say something about 22 for self-defense. We already let the cat out of the bag earlier. We think 380 is the way to go and above, but 22 is better than a stick. If that's the way you got to go because of, you can only afford one gun, and you want that one, and it's the only one you can shoot and manipulate. It's very easy to rack the slide on one of those. Very easy. Then that's the way it is. It's, lots of people are, use 22s to defend themselves in this country. It's a very popular round. And the only thing I would encourage you to do is make sure you fire lots and lots and lots of rounds of whatever ammunition you're going. This is actually applicable to all handguns you're going to use for self-defense, but make sure you fire lots of ammunition that you're going to use for self-defense through that gun to make sure it's reliable, because some ammunition is more reliable than others. And some ammunition is more reliable in a particular gun. Some guns, we say, some guns like certain ammunition is what we say. So make sure you test your ammo. There is a big difference in my experience, our experience, with respect to 22 caliber ammunition. The CCI stuff seems to perform the best. Now, we've not used it all. There's probably some out there that, it's particularly more expensive ammo that might be better. I don't know, but the CCI performs very admirably. And actually, we've had good luck with some of the cheaper stuff for training. What's it called? Aguilar?
Agula.
Agula. Yeah, it's done very, very, very well for us as well. And like I said, we can tell a difference in the ammunition when you've got lots of people shooting lots of 22. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a difference. And there's nothing wrong. I don't mean to degrade 22. It's rim fire, not center fire. We won't get into that today, but by virtue of how it's made, it's just innately going to be less reliable than 22 center fire ammunition.
And then then 9mm center fire ammunition. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So 22 rim fire is inherently going to be less reliable than center fire ammunition.
Yes.
So we've talked about the different action types. We talked about revolvers. We talked about striker fire versus the double action and single action. And we talked about our emphasis and our recommendation is generally for people to start out with a striker fire gun. We've also talked about size and weight, strength of your hands and how that may affect the firearm that you choose. We've talked about ammunition and caliber a little bit. So let's just touch on a few other things here real quickly. There are some nuances that people might consider if you're left-handed versus right-handed. Most of the population is right-handed, but there are many left-handed shooters out there, and this is an important consideration. Some firearms are more suited or designed to be either modified easily for a left-handed shooter or out of the box easier for a left-handed shooter. You want to say a little bit about that?
Just real quickly, and you live with this because Whitney, your wife, is a lefty, but we run into this a lot in training classes with left-handed folks. They buy a firearm that doesn't have controls that are amicable, if that's the word, but they're not useful for a left-hander. And just real quickly, when we teach things, we like to treat, with respect to gun handling, loading, unloading, malfunctions, we teach just a basic core of actions with that firearm so we can process those to the level of being unconsciously competent. We can just do it in the dark without even thinking about it. Well, if you don't have the for instance, the slide lock on the correct side of the gun, if you're a left-hander, it makes it difficult. You have to do something different and think about it. Or if the magazine release is not on the right side. So here's what I'd say about that. Make sure you have this the slide lock. Make sure it's ambidextrous on whatever gun you get. And with respect to the gun you get, make sure you can at least change the magazine release to suit a left-hander. Some guns will even have the magazine release already left and right-sided, so to speak. But make most of the guns, like the Glock 19, you're going to be able to switch. If you're a left-hander, you can switch the magazine release to the other side with relatively little difficulty. I'm going to go back to a Glock 19 because that's what I carry. The magazine, or strike that, the slide stop is on both sides. So left-hander or right-hander can operate that. But keep that in mind. We want it the same. We want the left-hander to be able to operate the firearm just like a right-hander can.
Yeah. And like you said, that's on many firearms like the Glock 19 and the Smith & Wesson M&P, the magazine release is reversible. Some firearms come with an ambidextrous magazine release and a ambidextrous slide stop, which means that it has both buttons on both sides of the firearm out of the box. The H&K VP9 is an example of that. The FN509 is another example. The Springfield XD M Elite, I can't remember. I think that's the model name. I think they are ambidextrous out of the box as well. So if that's something that's important to you, that's actually nice for us with me and my wife having an ambidextrous firearm because she can pick it up and it works for her. I can pick it up and it works for me. If that's a consideration for you, don't overlook that aspect.
Yeah, because we see a lot. Once again, that's one of those deals where people show up and they find out they bought the wrong firearm and they got to go back and do something differently.
I've installed an ambidextrous mag release on a Glock 19. I'm not comfortable enough to recommend it yet, but it seems to be working well so far. So that's also an option. That's the nice thing about the Glock and Smith & Wesson's is that they're so common, they're so popular, that there are lots of aftermarket parts and accessories for those. And we'll get into that some in just a little bit, I think.
I'll go ahead and go through some of these things real quickly. But I want to get back to the gadget or whatever they call it.
Well, the strike
control device for Glocks in a little bit. First of all, magazine capacity. A lot of people think about that. Most of these, the ones we've talked about, the compact, the Glock 19, the Smith & Wesson M&P 2.0 compact, I think it's fit. The Glock's 15-round magazine. So they're 15-round magazines. Is that terribly important that you have 15 versus 10? I don't know. But, you know, that's out there, something that you can consider as you move along. I will tell you this, that one thing to do keep in mind with regard to magazines is you're going to have to buy a lot of magazines. People think you're going to buy a gun, only come with two or three magazines. You need to buy a whole bunch more guns. And you need to treat magazines as expendable. When you train, they drop on the ground, you're going to beat them up. I have some that I carry that I try to keep kind of pristine.
And you said buy a bunch more guns, you mean buy a bunch more
magazines for your gun. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So that's important, what magazines cost, whether they're available, those sorts of things. Cost considerations for the firearm, we've already talked about this. You know, there's some that are at the budget end. They're still high quality. Maybe not quite as refined as if you go to Wilson Combat and get one for $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, whatever they cost. So there's a big range in cost. Quite frankly, a lot of times you're just, some of what you're paying for is just how much labor goes into a gun. For instance, 1911, you're probably not going to get a good 1911 unless you spend $1,000, a decent 1911 that you can depend on to save your life. A polymer striker fired gun, a lot less labor goes into those. They're going to be $500, $600 or less. So that's that may be a consideration for you.
I just want to say one other thing about magazine capacity real quickly. John Correa, and we encourage you to check out his channel if you don't know about it, Active Self-Protection on YouTube. He analyzes gunfights and deadly force encounters, and he has never seen somebody reload during a civilian gunfight. And
Except civilian police officers.
And so he says the fight always ends with however much ammunition you have in your magazine. And there were some situations where it may have been beneficial for the person to have more ammunition, but they always end the fight with the number of rounds in their gun. So higher capacity may be beneficial if you're planning to carry your firearm, but that's just sort of based on your risk tolerance and then how large you want your firearm to be.
Yeah, but I wouldn't get hung up on my magazines hold 15 versus 17. That wouldn't be a big deal for me. It's funny, in the training world, we emphasize reloads, even tactical reloads. But John Correa's research and his experience shows that that's not important, and except in the civilian world, except in the limited case of some police officers.
And this is these are lessons from him analyzing over 40,000 gunfights.
Yeah.
So it's not to say that it couldn't be beneficial, but it's not likely.
Well, as a matter of fact, most of the I can't think of one. Well, there probably are some, but most of the times when you see a reload in a civilian context with a police officer, it's not executed very well. So it's still important to train that and do it correctly, because most of the time they, you know, and I'm not criticizing, they're under enormous pressure, but they certainly didn't have the reload relegated to an unconscious competence skill level, the ones I've seen.
Yeah. All right. So we've talked about, I think, a lot of sort of high level considerations that people should consider here, size and weight, the strength of their hands for manipulating the firearm, recoil. You know, the larger the firearm, the less recoil you'll perceive generally, left versus right-handed, magazine capacity, maintenance and reliability. Most firearms, Glock, Smith & Wesson, SIG, etc., are going to be very reliable firearms that require very little maintenance, especially if you just follow what's in the owner's manual. And cost. One thing we haven't talked about much is sight options. What should people look for there?
Well, real quickly, a lot of that's personal preference. Here's one downside of the Glocks. I think all mine get changed, or I buy one that already have better sights. They have plastic sights. I don't like their little white back outline and all that. So a lot of this is personal preference. I'm older, so I like at least some sort of fiber optic on the front. It catches my eye, and I get that flash sight picture. Listen to last week's episode about flash sight picture. But, you know, something brighter on the front is good for me. Do you need a night sight? No, you don't need it. Could it be better in some circumstances? Yeah. But if you can't see the target, you don't need to be shooting. So I don't know. It doesn't necessarily help, except in those very small set of circumstances. Does it really help? Because you got to identify the target. If you can identify the target, you can probably see your sights. So to me, it's more of a, I like something a little brighter for my older eyes. Some people want, this is a new thing, I don't have a red dot on a pistol yet. I want to try it. Have them on rifles. That's depends on who you ask. But that may be the trend. It is the trend right now. And that may, all of them may have it before it's over with, because red dot technology may get so good that if they're smaller and lighter. I would suggest to you, though, before you go to a red dot, learn the basics of sight alignment, sight picture. And how to use a firearm with just the, what we call the iron sights, which are traditional sights. There are also lasers. I'm not a super big fan of lasers on a pistol for novices, because I think sometimes novices think that's going to be a substitute for skill. It isn't. Just learn with the iron sights, and then go from there. In my experience, actually, the folks with lasers, you know, we talk about speed and accuracy. Their speed is slower. You ever seen a cat chase a, you ever play with a cat and have him chase a, or her chase a laser pointer? That's kind of what people do with those lasers, it seems to me. Just one guy's personal opinion based on limited experience. So I wouldn't start with a laser. Just start with the basics. Learn to use the handgun with iron sights.
Yep. So one thing, we're planning to talk about peripherals a little bit as well, in addition to the firearm itself.
We might do that on a separate episode.
We're coming up on an hour here, so I think we'll save that. But one thing that I'll just mention real quickly is that if you stick to something that's a relatively popular or mainstream firearm, like a Glock 19 or a Smith & Wesson MP or a SIG P320 or a P365, et cetera, something that's relatively popular, it's going to give you a lot more options for accessories like holsters and magazines, et cetera. Much easier to find parts. If you have high round count, you need to replace parts. So we encourage people to stick with more mainstream popular firearms when you're selecting a handgun.
I helped a former student out just recently with that. She had a firearm that was, she asked me about some holsters and I'm not an expert on holsters, but I'll give you my two cents. And it was very, I did a little research for it, and it's very difficult to find holsters for that particular gun, any holsters.
Yeah. So I think next week, we'll just plan on doing the peripherals next week, maybe split it into a separate episode.
Okay.
And we'll talk about eye protection, hearing protection, your belts, holsters, range bags, individual first aid kits, et cetera. I think we'll save that for a separate episode because we could go another hour on that, I think. So I think that's where we'll leave it for now. I think if you want to have...
Do you want to talk about the gadget next week?
I think we can... That's an accessory
or a
modification of some sort.
To sum up then.
But I hope this was helpful for folks and especially beginners looking to start out with a firearm for self-defense. Remember, what you hear at the gun store is not necessarily going to be the right thing. In fact, we've had lots of people led astray when selecting their first firearm at the gun store. So think about, you know, these considerations, size and weight. Smaller is not easier to shoot. 9mm versus 380, et cetera. Think about these things. We hope it's been helpful. But I think what I want to emphasize more than anything is if you can seek out training before you select a firearm, we highly encourage you to do that. Go to the training, learn more than anything, the mindset that you need, the safety rules, et cetera, that go into owning and using a firearm responsibly. So we highly encourage you to seek out training. If you already have a firearm, we still encourage you to seek out training because more important than the gun itself is the person behind it. So definitely look into reputable trainers and training in your area. So next week, we'll save the peripherals for next Monday, Gun Day. Thanks again for joining the show, Mike.
Appreciate it.
And Sunday, I'll be releasing an episode next Sunday about some new attendees to the Homesteading Festival at Hardison Mill in Columbia, Tennessee. My wife and a few of her friends went to that festival and came away, I think, inspired, rejuvenated about the world and, you know, having been around like-minded people. And I want to share their experience with you. So I hope you'll tune in for that. And we'll see you again next week for Monday Gun Day when we'll talk about peripherals. Thanks, everybody. And remember, until next time, you are the Forge of Freedom.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Forge of Freedom. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss a future episode. For more information or to connect with Alex, you can go to forgeoffreedom.com. Or follow him on Twitter @ForgeOfFreedom. Until next time, remember, you are the Forge of Freedom.